You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Today we'll be hearing from Alexander Masters about his book A Life Discarded, based on the discovery of 148 notebook diaries in a skip in Cambridge. And we'll also be talking to Sarah Vaughan about her second novel, The Farm at the Edge of the World, which is set in Cornwall. Our studio guest today is Helen Callaghan. Hello, Helen.
Hi there.
Helen is author of Dear Amy, a psychological thriller. We'll be coming back to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Helen. But Sarah's book is set in Cornwall. Alexander's book is set in Cambridge. And your book is set in Cambridge.
Yes, it is.
Was it important that it was set in Cambridge?
It was a decision that I made quite early on. Original drafts of the book had actually been set somewhere else. It was originally set in Manchester. But when I moved up to Cambridge, it would have been about 3 years ago, it suddenly struck, well, the book needs to be set here, because there were things about Cambridge that were very, very useful to me, because it's this town of contrasts, and there are contrasts in the book, and there are social contrasts, and also there are environmental contrasts. So there's like this town, very beautiful medieval town, and then all around it you have these like sort of flat, misty, creepy fens. And I thought to myself, well, this is absolutely great, because, you know, in a lot of ways, Dear Amy is two stories. And the heroine kind of inhabits these two environments. And I thought that's perfect, because that, you know, that does what I want. It's
what lies underneath, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yes.
Does it make you a hostage to fortune, though? Because people who read the book and know Cambridge might say, well, you know, it got very quickly from there to there. It normally takes about 10 minutes, that kind of thing. Did you walk the routes?
I did. I am a bit, I would say that I was, I'm not necessarily over, because I think you can be too hung up on these things. But I would not like to write something that I didn't know to be true. And, you know, I have lived here for a while, and I went to university here back in the day. I do know Cambridge. And so as a consequence, I felt that it was, you know, I think it's true enough. I'm happy that, you know, it's not like, you know, some of these like mad movies you see where, you know, I mean, somebody runs out of the Houses of Parliament and suddenly they're in Greenwich. And which, you know, I mean, just does throw... I mean, I can get over it, but that does kind of throw me out.
It takes you out of the moment a little
bit, doesn't it?
I mean, talking to Anne Cleves, who wrote the Shetland novels, we had her on the show a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying, no, do you know what? I don't worry that much about that. I'm writing a work of fiction. I mean, there's that argument as well, isn't there?
Well, absolutely. I think it's a bit difficult with crime, because crime is, of all the genres, is very interested in realism. And people that enjoy crime, you know, they enjoy realism. And it's very, very hard to say, because everybody's level for when they're thrown out of a thing, for when they lose that suspension of disbelief, is different. And really, ideally, you probably want to sort of like, you know, try and keep them in there, because when there's nothing worse than being thrown out of a book. It really is. It's like being thrown out of a nightclub. Well, unceremoniously.
Or when the lights go up at the end.
Yes.
I suppose if you're thrown out of a book that way, then you're wondering what else to disbelieve. And you want people to believe things and disbelieve other things, because you're playing with them all the time.
It's very interesting, because it's all about confidence. So in a lot of ways, when you write the book, you're not actually writing what happens. You're creating a framework that the reader inhabits with their own imagination. And when you make that difficult for them, you know, you're really not doing yourself any favours. And I think as well, when you're writing particularly psychological thrillers or something with a gothic tinge, there are going to be things that are outside your normal experience that are going to be, you know, sort of like that are going to be sort of like going to be imaginable, but not things that happen like every day of the week. So if you've got that going on, like, why would you undermine that with, you know, sort of cutting corners on the research side?
Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. We'll hear your first choice of music now, which is Peter Gabriel, No Self-Control. Why this one?
Okay, so this is very interesting because it's a song about addiction and mental illness, which features in Dear Amy. And also, in a lot of ways, it was part of the soundtrack for that very first draft that that I wrote years and years ago. And I was thinking about what music I would suggest for this. And I thought, you know, that this is the nicest marriage of content and also in the history of the book. It's the thing that was playing in the background while I was writing it.
That's No Self-Control by Peter Gabriel, the first choice of music today on Bookmark from our studio guest, Helen Callahan. Helen worked for 10 years as a fiction specialist and buyer for a variety of bookshops. Her debut novel, Dear Amy, was published last year. Described as a psychological thriller, it became a Sunday Times bestseller. Helen, for people who haven't read Dear Amy, can you give us a brief resume of the plot?
Yes, certainly. So Dear Amy is a story of Margot Lewis, who is a school teacher working and living in Cambridge. And one of the things she does part time is that she's an agony aunt for the local paper. And she, despite this, she's having a lot of problems herself. Her marriage is falling apart and she has her own issues. And what happens is that she starts to receive letters begging for help from a girl called Bethan Avery, who claims that she's been kidnapped and kept in a cellar. And when Margot investigates this, she finds out that Bethan Avery actually went missing nearly 20 years ago, so the letters must be a hoax. But the letters keep coming, and something about them sort of tugs at her, and she starts to look into it, and that is when things start to, you know,
things do start to happen.
Things start to happen, yes.
Start to unravel.
Rather a lot.
Now, that idea of young women being abducted, kept in cellars, of course, we've heard lots of stories about that over the last 10 years or so. Horrific stories. Was that where the idea came from?
Well, actually, no, because the genesis of the novel is actually quite a bit older. I was like a teenager when I started thinking about Dear Amy. So I think, though, these stories have always existed. Yeah, there were cases in the 70s, there were cases, you know, through the 80s. And how I think about it is these terrible things, you know, happen in real life. But what I do is it's entertainment in that sense. So what it is it's an exploration of my personal fears. And then I write a book about it, and then people get to explore their personal fears through reading it. And the fact that these things happen and the fact that I'm afraid of them is linked. But I don't necessarily think that it's a case of, I mean, like, I wouldn't like to say that Dear Amy is based on any individual case or any individual person's suffering. But I think that these are universal fears, especially for women. And because, like, when I grew up, about the time I was writing this, the big story of the day was the Yorkshire Ripper. And I actually was, like, living up north then. I was kind of, like, in his catchment area. And it's kind of, like, impossible to overstate the amount of sheer fear that was going on. And I remember there were posters up in the schools, there were posters up in, you know, in post offices, you know, and remember it was that hoax tape was on the go. So it was like, you know, do you know someone that sounds like the voice on the tape? You know what I mean? And it was very like, you know, don't go out alone at night if you're a woman, you know, take a friend, think about the journeys that you make at night, which is actually quite, you know, very, you know, hobbling and, you know, sort of like life disabling stuff. And it's that sense of, you know, and, you know,
jeopardy. And I was in Yorkshire as well at the time. Oh, I remember it very well. To write about that, how was that tapping into those fears? I mean, it's very well sort of identifying those as fears, but to then say, right, I'm going to live with this fear for however long it took you to write the book.
Because at the end, you will have, to a certain extent, work through the fear. When the fear's like when fears are unbearable, you can either dismiss them or, and I was kind of drawn to that. So imagine like the worst thing that you can possibly imagine happening to you and sort of try and move through that. And you know what I mean? And sort of, you know, and almost in a way sort of rescue yourself from that fear. And or explore that to its, you know, to face up to it, to explore it to its logical limits. And that essentially is what Dear Amy is about. And I think that is what all these psychological thrillers are about. They are those quotidian fears. There's a stranger danger fear, but there are also domestic fears and, you know, the fear of betrayal or do you really know your loved ones? And I think that's why it's so very popular.
Because the stories of abducting women and abducting children, putting women in jeopardy, which they certainly are in your novel, there are moments, you know, I read it where your heart beats faster, you think, goodness me. Some people would say that might be exploitative.
Well, and I do get it. And certainly I made a decision quite early on in Dear Amy that nothing would be too explicit. You would never see too, I mean, there's reasonable violence. I didn't want to show too much sexual violence. I didn't want to, or torture, or, and, you know, and everyone has like their different level. And there are people that are writing that, you know, that much more explicit material, and they would be able to tell you, well, I feel that that's okay because, you know, this is like a cathartic thing and I'm pursuing that to its, you know, its logical conclusion. I didn't like to do it because, and I can't say because I just don't like to. I don't like to write that stuff. I find the suggestible element of it is more compelling anyway. People can imagine worse things than me, I'm sure.
But when you write a first novel in that genre, do you find that that's what people are going to expect from you ever onwards, that they're going to define you that way? Maybe not your... told me you're working on your second novel, maybe that's completely different. But are you worried that it sort of sets you on that path?
Well, there is an element that particularly when you write a novel like that, and it does, you know what I mean, it's sort of like, it's been much more successful than I imagine. I'm, you know what I mean, I'm absolutely blown away by what's happened. But I guess my feeling is that, because I have written, I have experimented with other genres and written various things, and I, you know what I mean, sort of, I do love that. But I think as a follow-up to Dear Amy, I think it would be fair enough to make it the kind of book that people that enjoy Dear Amy would enjoy. And I'm sure my publisher feels that way too. So, and I did have ideas for that, actually. The second book's about a cult. So about some, well, the second book's about... a woman that comes home and finds her mother's killed herself. And then in the course of things, she finds out that her mother was in a cult in her youth and was in the process of writing a book about it. So, and then she starts to investigate that and you know, it all starts to unravel as it inevitably does. And in that sense, and I, you know, sort of like, I've got ideas for books 3 and 4, so...
And that's, because I said psychological thriller, and it is a psychological thriller, Dear Amy. It's not a crime novel. There is enough psychology in it and working through an explanation that, for me, lifts it away from the crime genre. Not to do down the crime genre, because I like crime novels, but it's more exploring the head, isn't it? More exploring what's going on inside the head.
Well, I think it's fair to say, really, that... because I'm kind of fascinated by the Gothic, you see. And I think that there is a very strong, like, Gothic element all the way through Dear Amy. And in probably, you know, in even all the books that I've fiddled about with and, you know, and the things that I finished, they all have this strong Gothic element. That's what draws me. I love those Victorian Gothic novels and, you know, and a bit of Anne Radcliffe. Yay, great.
Hammer horror.
Yeah, exactly. And it's what I was raised on. And you know, and that's what Hammer Horror is all about, exploring those cathartic fears. So,
well, looking at fears, we'll take a sidestep away from Dear Amy just for a moment to hear Sarah Vaughan's first novel, The Art of Baking Blind, was published in 2014 and translated into numerous languages. Her second, The Farm at the Edge of the World, was published last year. It's set vividly in Cornwall, alternating between the 1940s and the present day, as a former child evacuee, now a dying old lady, tries to atone for past mistakes. When I met Sarah, I asked her if Cornwall was a part of the country she knew well.
I was brought up in Devon, but I spent summer holidays in North Cornwall, and my mum's family were farmers, actually from the south of Cornwall, so it's somewhere that I felt a strong pull to. We'd go there each summer to this area outside Padstow that I've written about, and I'd also spend a lot of my childhood being dragged up cliffs and walking along cliff walks, which I might have resented at the time, but which now I realise were really important to me. And then since I've had children, we've taken them back to the same place. So it's a place that's really resonant with me, with lots of memories.
It's a beautiful part of the country, and the way you describe it, your landscape writing, is also very beautiful.
That's, I think, the part of the novel I'm proudest of. I've always loved novels with a really strong sense of place. Places like, books like, you know, The Go-Between or Atonement or Wuthering Heights or, you know, Return of the Native. I read an awful lot of Hardy while I was writing this. I really wanted to get a real sense of the moors and the sea and the cliffs and the sand and physically swimming in the sea and all those things. I wanted the tastes and the smells, and I really wanted to try and transport the reader there, because the place, in a way, the farm at the edge of the world, is almost the most important character. And part of the inspiration for this book was wanting to evoke this place that has such a strong tug on me. When I take my kids there now, they laugh because it just has this Pavlovian response. I start crying when I see the view, which is utterly ridiculous and sentimental. But I think it's because when I was a child, it was the place I associated with being happiest. And so when I return now, all those memories that are tight-packed come tumbling back.
And is the farm itself based on a real-life place, a real-life farm?
No, it's a sort of amalgam of different Cornish granite house farmhouses that I've stayed in. The spot that I envisage is on the cliffs outside Padstow. I've stayed on a farm overlooking a cove called Harbour Clove, and elements of that fed its way in. Equally, we've stayed in a Tudor farmhouse in the South Hams, which is South Devon, and the granite nature of that farmhouse has fed its way in. In researching this, I went to visit three farmers in farmhouses on the edge of the moor, and one of those farmhouses was a low-slung granite farmhouse. And as part of my research, I drove down there and got lost on the moor and took countless pictures of lovely granite farmhouses down there.
Well, you mentioned your research there, because this is a working farm that the story is set on.
Oh, this is very much a working farm.
And you put a lot of farming information in there. It's beautifully done, but I thought, yes, either Sarah knows more about farming than I thought, or her research has been very thorough.
So my great-grandfather, Matthew Gelbert, farmed just outside St Austell, and my mum's cousin later took on the farm. So part of the inspiration for this was my mum's memories of bringing in the harvest in the 50s. They would go down each August and spend 3 weeks down there. And for her, these were the happiest weeks of her childhood as well. So I wanted to capture, in my time slip story, in my wartime story, I wanted to capture the environment then. But I also was really concerned that I didn't write a sentimentalised Cornish buckets and spades ice creamy type story. I wanted to talk about farming as it is now, you know, I think there's something like two farmers a week commit suicide. I mean, it's a really harsh existence, particularly for tenant farmers, I think, down there at the moment. So there was a sort of two-pronged approach. Part of it involved interviewing these octogenarian farmers who'd all been 15-year-old farm boys during the war. I actually went and talked to them about how you milk a cow and things like that. And alongside that, poring over old family photographs of my great-grandfather and my grandfather bringing in the harvest and talking to my mum's cousin about it. And then the modern parallel was talking to people from the NFU and the Farm Crisis Network, and my stepfather's brother is an organic dairy farmer in Devon. So I went and watched the cows being milked there and to quiz them at length about, you know, exactly how much feed and how much milk production there would be. So I really got into that element as well.
So you know a lot about farming now.
I know. Well, I know a little bit more than I did to start with. I was really concerned. I think it's the journalist in me. I was really concerned that nobody would read this and say, oh, well, that's the wrong amount of yield of milk and that's the wrong time of farming. And, you know, I got in a real tizzy because somebody said to me, oh, actually, their afternoon milking was done at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, my Devon farmers had told me it was at 4 o'clock. And I was really worried that I I get the timings wrong. I'm sure nobody else would notice, but it mattered to me.
It matters to you. Yeah. You've also got evacuees there in your wartime story
as well. So that required a lot of research as well. I'm, in fact, looking back at it, this was my tricky second novel, but it also required quite a lot of research. And I was also paranoid that I would get some war detail wrong, because although the war, it's kind of ever present and it's felt, not least because you've got these sort of bombers flying off from airfields in the north of Cornwall. But, you know, obviously I'm not writing about people undergoing campaigns in North Africa or Italy or whatever. I needed to get those details completely right. And I needed to find out, for instance, the date that the regiment in that area went off to North Africa. And I wanted to get all those things right. I don't want to do a spoiler, but there is an actual event that happened, that the date in which it happened is in the book. And actually, I use that for quite dramatic effect a bit later on.
But you're writing a work of fiction as well, aren't you? And you're tying the two together. You say you were inspired by a quote from Kate Atkinson: sometimes to find the truth at the heart of a book, a little bit of reality falls by the wayside.
So I loved Life After Life. It was really freeing reading Kate Atkinson's author's note at the end, where she mentions, I think she talks about writing about a road being bombed in the Earl's Court area, SW5, and knowing that actually that road wasn't particularly bombed there, but roads in nearby streets were. And I found that really freeing, because at one point I actually bought a pamphlet detailing all the bombs that had ever fallen on Cornwall during the war, and it was written by the daughter of an air raid ward, the air raid warden down there. And I was desperately trying to marry up these events with my narrative. In the end, it doesn't matter. We know that bombs... I know, for instance, I mention a bomb falling on Prideaux Place, and a bomb did fall on Prideaux Place in 1941. But I don't know that the glass shattered. I'm imagining that the glass... I have tried to research that. There is an element of creative flexibility there.
It's because it's within living memory, isn't it? And you worry that somebody's going to read that and say, that didn't really happen. Although I think most people, when they're reading a work of fiction, they can give it a bit a bit of wriggle room.
I was also partly inspired by my grandmother and my elderly next door neighbour, who both died 4 and 3 years ago at the age of 95. They were both barely talked about the war, but you just get the occasional snippet that made you realise that they'd had this experience that our generation, subsequent generations, can never comprehend. I hope it doesn't sound trite, but I thought in a way I was trying to write a book that would come close to capturing their experience, because I think they were the last generation as a whole that have ever had to be truly brave. And I think when we were children, I can remember when I did my GCSE history, I could talk to my grandfather, you know, in the mid-80s, late-80s, I could talk to my grandfather, you know, the war was 45 years earlier. My children, it's a different millennium. It's they've got no concept of that. So I think the fact that they'd recently died, these two 95-year-olds, I wanted to sort of be true to their memories, yeah.
And you called it earlier, just a moment ago, the tricky second novel. Actually, having read your first novel and reading this, I can see that you have really matured as a writer. Does it feel that way for you?
Yes, I think so. Now, I think when you're in the... I had a two-book deal, so there are slight expectations that the second book would be similar to the first book. When I sort of produced it for my editor, there were things she wanted to change, and, you know, quite a lot she wanted to change. I think I just had a sort of slight, I don't know if I threw my toys out of the pram, but I just threw 55,000 words away and really thought about it. Whoa. And really thought about the things that mattered to me about this book, and went back down to Cornwall and got lost in the mist on the moor and tried to intensify the emotion of the novel. And she said it was unrecognisable when I got it back to her. And I think that a fellow mum at school said, you look pretty miserable for a few months. And I said, well, it's because, you know, she saw me stomping to and fro. And it's because I really felt I had to wrestle with it. But equally, having done a creative writing course or anything, I really feel this is the novel in which I learned to be a writer. I mean, I hope that doesn't sound derogatory about my first novel, but this is the novel in which I really got to grips with it, because structurally it's quite complex.
Structurally it's very complex. You feel more, it feels more confident from you as a writer as well. And the things you do in this that you wouldn't have done in the first novel, perhaps the time slip, for example.
Yes. And the third novel, which I'm currently editing at the moment, I'm reading it now and I'm thinking, gosh, this is more robust, this is tighter and tauter, and, well, probably more in the vein of this, and that has a time slip as well. And I have played around with time and a bit more on that as well. So, yeah, I think it was a very steep learning curve. I feel I can sort of justify saying I'm an author now, if that doesn't sound...
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I think I can justify saying that.
And landscape writing itself is very difficult. The landscape that you're describing, which is perfect for the novel, the idea of secrets and things being hidden and raw emotions. But to describe that in a way that doesn't become repetitive is quite challenging.
Well, I did actually. I was saying I chopped out 55,000 words. Then in final edit, I chopped out, I think, 8,000 words on hedgerows. Or well, not quite, but, you know, hedgerows and cliffs. There was, it's pacing as well, isn't it? And when you're getting down to that final thing, there were just comments from the editors about, do we need this passage on hedgerows? It's beautiful, but do we need it here because it slows the pace? And that was quite hard because some of it was, you know, had taken me quite a while to craft. And again, I was obsessed about which flora and fauna would be in season at the time. You know, I was going down there and taking pictures of red campions and hazel and, you know, sloes and things, and trying to marry it all together with the seasons and things, making sure.
But that kind of research is still in there, probably.
Yes,
isn't it?
It is in there. Yeah, as you say, I think it's a more confident book. To feel confident about writing it, to feel just in the same way that by immersing myself in the farming research and in the wartime research, I felt I could write more confidently and robustly about it. I'm not very good at winging it, I don't think.
So the third book.
I'm not allowed to say very much about it because
what
maybe
are you
we want
allowed
to keep
to say?
The suspense. I can say that it's called Anatomy of a Scandal. It's sold to Simon & Schuster in the UK and to an imprint of that in the US. And I've just got my 11th deal, which was to Russia, which was yesterday. And it's also going to be published to my German and French publishers that I'm already with. So that's a bit of a dream, really. And it's a bit darker. We're calling it a psychological drama. The issue is very topical. It draws a lot on my experience as a journalist. And it's something I feel very passionately about.
Sounds intriguing, doesn't it? That's Sarah Vaughan there talking about her second novel, The Farm at the Edge of the World, which is published by Hodder and Stoughton. I'm in the studio with Helen Callahan, author of Dear Amy. You were nodding a lot there, Helen, when Sarah was talking about research.
Yes, that she was I love that. And she's describing, wandering the moors, taking loads of pictures, like, oh God, in the rain, I've done that. It's really great.
Well, you must feel a duty. There's a lot about psychology in your book, isn't there? And you must have felt a duty to get that right.
I did. I feel that, again, I didn't really want to sort of, you know, have the book too similar to individual cases or anything. So in a lot of things that happen in the book are logical consequences as opposed to, here's the case where, you know, such and such. And I felt that, I don't really want to say too much.
I know, it's very tricky. Oh, yes, yes,
very,
I have this problem
hard
with Alexander Masters later on, how much to give away, yes. But there are certain syndromes that we won't go into it, but you must have done a lot of research, medical and psychological research.
I did. I read a fair bit, actually. And one of the things that I didn't get to do was, I was hoping to talk to a psychologist. It never panned out in the end. But I read around that.
And so the internet is invaluable these days, isn't it?
It is. But you have to be really careful with the internet. I had a couple of cases where I was going to confidently assert a thing, and then I thought, yeah, I don't think I can just say that just because it's in Wikipedia. And then when you look into it, you think, actually, no, you can't actually say that. So
don't tell me Wikipedia lies. Is there nothing sacred?
I know. No, Wikipedia is normally very good. The only problem is, like, Wikipedia is like this rabbit hole. You can start reading about thing, and then, you know, click a link, and then your day's gone. It's like, I have written zero words, but I know all about this stuff that has nothing to do with my novel. So, you know, it's good.
Right, well, let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is Oasis and Wonderwall. Why this one?
Okay, it's interesting because Sarah was talking about time slips. So there are two sort of time zones in Dear Amy. There is the modern day, and then there is the Cambridge of the 90s, which is where Beth and Avery is living. And one of the things that I seem to remember about this, one of the period details, was the fact that people sort of had Blur and Oasis in opposition. So it was a couple of the teenage characters are talking about how one likes Blur and one likes Oasis. And funnily enough, this record, this particular one, Wonderwall, was the one that was playing everywhere when I first came up to Cambridge in the 90s. And I just thought it would be nice to have something from the historical context with the book. So, and who doesn't love Wonderwall? So I chose it.
today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today is author of the psychological thriller Dear Amy, Helen Callahan. Helen, we were talking earlier about the difficulty almost of talking about your book, and we'll hear more a similar sort of story from Alexander Masters in just a moment. In terms of red herrings and secrets, all those things that are part of a psychological thriller, how did you plot it? Did you have lots of post-it notes on the wall, or was it a first draft and then you filled it in as ideas came to you?
It was a couple of things. I have to say that. So the first draft of this book was written in this like mad white heat over about 8 weeks. And it's the first time I've ever had that with a book where the idea just appeared out of whole cloth in my head and just I powered through. And which is actually, it's a really great way to do a first draft because it gives it tightness and cohesion. Even if it's rough about the edges, that is something that you can fix. But I think the problem was I was really quite young then. I was quite inexperienced. It was the first thing I ever finished. And I think I was about 21. Oh, God, some ridiculous age. Anyway, so... what happened was there were various, so there's various sleight of hand that goes on, spoilers, very sleight of hand that goes on in Dear Amy. And I think that when you're a young author, there are certain things, you over-explain things. I said that great line out of Silence of the Lambs when Hannibal Lecter says, the elaborations of a bad liar. And that is essentially, I think, what, was kind of a problem with the first draft. But then as you write other things and you go, and it was kind of funny how the book came around because I'd managed to get an agent in, nearly 10 years ago. God, she's stuck with me. And I'd written various things and they'd been well regarded and, you know, and people said lovely things, but no one was actually spending any money on them. And my agent says, well, do you have anything else? And I said, well, I've got this thing that, that I've always kind of like, you know, admired. I think is a goer, but I've not looked at it for ages. And she goes, oh, dust that off and come back with it in about 6 weeks and we'll have a think. And I just read it through and I just thought, this is not 6 weeks worth of work. This is not going to be happening. And it was a year later. So I pretty much like completely rebuilt it from the ground up. And when I'd done that, it sold in 10 days.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Good work. Good work. Yeah,
there was an auction. It was like, I'm like, oh my God. It's like,
well
it was
done.
Very, very strange.
That was a good piece of rebuilding. I don't think we gave too much away there. it is hard. As you'll hear, as also in this interview with Alexander Masters, Alexander's first book, Stuart, A Life Backwards, was a Sunday Times bestseller and won the Guardian First Book Award and the Whitbread Book of the Year 2005 in the biography category. As the title suggests, it tells the life story in reverse, starting in the present and working backwards, of Stuart, a homeless man with a history of violence. Masters' latest book, A Life Discarded, similarly challenges the biography genre. It's a detective story following the discovery in 2011 in a skip in Cambridge of 148 notebook diaries. Over 5 years, Masters uncovers the identity and history of the diarist. When I met him at the Cambridge Literary Festival last year, I asked Alexander at what point he realised that this was a biographical mystery he didn't necessarily want to solve.
Well, I think as soon as I got close to solving it, I began to think, well, I rather enjoy this. You know, I'm enjoying chasing this person, trying to find out who this person is and why these books were thrown away. And by that time, I'd begun to learn a little bit about the writer and begun to feel a sort of friendship, something akin to a friendship with the writer. And with the friendship came a desire not to ruin it by discovery. It's, I think, like a lot of friendships, you build it up over years. That's a part of the pleasure of a friendship, is you take some time to really get to know someone. If I found out who had written them and all about it, then it would have put an end to that.
And it wasn't just the diarist that you were getting to know, was it? You also were getting to know yourself.
I think there was an element of that as well, and also the diarist would be writing about something and I'd recognise that as a quality of my own, or recognise that as not a quality of my own at all, and have a little argument with the diarist and so on. So there was that, which came out of the fact that it was a completely unstructured narrative. It was, I mean, the term nonfiction doesn't really apply to it. It was just a person telling you about what it was like to be themselves. And you become engrossed in their world, in the little nuances of their world. And so there was a sort of a gossipy element about it as well. And gossiping with someone is quite revealing. You know, you learn about your own prejudices and your own desires and your own... It was like having a long conversation with this writer.
Did you ever feel that you were intruding? Reading somebody's diary is a very personal thing to do.
I was intruding all the time and enjoyed it. You know, I mean, like most people, I like doing things I shouldn't do. And there was a sort of nice gossipy quality to it. There were moments when I felt I needed to tread carefully. And certainly if I was going to write about this, I had to tread very carefully, because you can't really go on with great hobnail boots and march through someone's life in that way. You have to treat it with some delicacy. And so there would be that, but it wouldn't stop me reading. I'd go on reading because I was interested in this life and I was interested in how it was going to work and how the writer would get over the various problems that occurred. So the sense of just feeling guilty about reading someone's private papers didn't bother me a great deal, I have to say. It's probably a bad thing about me, but it didn't. I was too excited by it, and I enjoyed the sort of sense of forbiddenness and secrecy. It was great.
And the way you've written it is almost like a diary, in that we discover, as you discover, more about the diarist as it goes along. You decided to do it that way rather than bring the end to the beginning, if you like.
Of course, and I think the point of that is that the excitement when you see something that's unresolved or mysterious, I wanted to keep that sense of mystery as I had enjoyed it for as long as possible. And when I would employ a detective, I mean, I did employ a very good Cambridge detective, and I employed a handwriting expert, again, a very good local person. Going through that and trying to replicate what I had felt as I was approaching that, I didn't want to give the mystery away because it would have taken half the fun. So I spent quite a lot of time trying to give a sense of how it had felt for me, and how that sense of just gradual exposure, and you think you're onto something, you think you've got the nature of this person sorted out, and you're completely wrong. So these blissful red herrings would crop up. It was like a detective story in the sense that it had the pleasure for me of a kind of a thriller with no body but a body of books.
And it's very funny. I mean, you have a very dry sense of humour, and that comes out.
Well, it is, and the writer's very funny. Can I just say, have we declared that it's a woman?
Well, that's... I wanted to ask you about that, how we talk about it and how you talk about it.
OK, because... well, I can give that away. I'd sort of rather not if I... No, I don't mind giving that away. I don't mind giving that away. The writer is a very good humorous writer, and she has these moments of great wit and observation about life and about herself. And she gets caught in these extraordinarily strange circumstances, entirely of her own devising. Those are very, very funny. I think humour is very important, particularly for this type of writing. You're writing about someone who no one has heard about, and you've got to get a person, the reader, interested in... you know, a person picks up the book, you've got no right to expect them to like your book. You've got to do something to try and engage them. And so it seems you have a very variety of ways of doing that, and humour is one, and mystery is another. And you've got to do that to begin to say to the reader, look, I think I do have something here that's worth continuing with. Please buy me. Humour also, I find, is a much richer way than, say, if you have a poignant moment. Often you get much more, it seems to me, you get much more emotional richness out of describing that if you use a bit of humour, because the humour can unexpectedly bring you up sharp. Just when you think, oh, I've got that all summed up, this is a sadness in this sort of way, and you introduce a bit of humour, it sort of makes the whole thing a little bit more complex and interesting. I've always felt that it's a very important part of writing, and if you can get it, you should do it, you should use it.
And what it made me reflect on is the difficulty for fiction writers of writing a diary, because what you were looking at is completely uncensored, as she doesn't explain who she is or who these people are. You wouldn't in a diary, because you know that, but of course in fiction it has to be explained, it has to be hinted at.
I think so, and I think one thing that I was very interested in after reading all these diaries was, why isn't there a central area where all diaries are stored? Now, there are various little organisations, well, big organisations, some of them, but various attempts to do this. And they're all limited in some way, just because it's such a mammoth task. But it seems to me if you had a central body, like say, something coordinated by the British Library or the University Library here, and people would pay a certain amount of money in order to have the diaries of their grandparents or themselves, you know, stored. Now, that seems to me a place that fiction writers should come, and they should stop, they should give up trying to imagine everything and come and actually do some field work, do some research, and come out, and if they want to write about, say, I don't know, a train driver from some, I don't know, from St. Ives, let's say, then you'd ring up this place and you'd say, do you have any diaries from train drivers from St. Ives? And they'd say, no, no, but we've got someone who's a train driver, and we've got someone. And then they'd come along and they'd do their research at this place, this central repository of all diaries. And I think that there's a real value in diaries, both to social historians, people like me who just want to write biographies, but to fiction writers especially, to give them the material so they don't have to make it up, because they're never going to get the stuff, the quality of the stuff that you get if you go out and you do your research and you read about what these lives were really like. And they're all in these lost diaries. Well, they're not lost, they're in people's attics, they're in people's boxes somewhere, but they're all there, available, and they contain accounts of fascinating lives.
And that's fascinating lives over the centuries. What struck me reading this diary was I had to keep reminding myself that we're talking about the 50s and 60s and 70s, because in many parts it felt like much further back, a Victorian diary of a young woman.
Yes, a Victorian or an Edwardian diary. And I think that if you were trying to imagine such a person, trying to imagine what it would be like to be a very lonely person who feels their life has not arrived at very much, which is a very common theme in fiction after all, then you need to go along and read the diaries of such a person, because only then will you really understand the nuances. Otherwise, it's all you imagining it, and you're not going to get it right. And you really need to understand that the drama that takes place, but where it takes place, is a place you'd never expect. These sort of moments of absolute fury that take over the person, these moments of desperate poignancy, these moments of recollection, and the way they're done in relation to this one life that you would think was quite flat in terms of its possible references because not much had happened to it. It's fascinating. You get this really, once you're down at the level of this person's life, you know, the things, the incidents that go on in this person's life, there is, from that perspective, a peaks of someone who is a South Seas adventurer, you know, but they're all done in this tiny little domestic setting. And you really need to read it. You can't make that up. Unless it's a life you've had yourself, then you're by personal reference. But you can't make it up. You need to read it to really understand how that life works. And it's a great mistake, I think. Here I'm bashing on about fiction writers again, but it's a great mistake to feel that you can rely on imagination to bring up such a character. You'll never get it. You'll never get the humour. You'll never get the oddities. You'll never get the eccentricities and the quirks of behaviour that are so important to making, in the diary of this person, the person live.
Now, you're here at the Cambridge Literary Festival, and we've touched on it earlier. How do you talk about this book? Because it is a series of revelations and constant surprises. Do you assume your audience has read it and knows the ending,
I could assume they'd read it. That would be lovely, wouldn't it? They'd all read it, and we could all talk as a great club. No, I don't assume they've read it, and I think it's a mystery story, so you can't give away the twists and the conclusion. And there are lots of lovely twists, and there is a shocking conclusion, or a shocking end result. I have to give away, I think, otherwise I just become tedious if I don't give away the fact that it's a woman who wrote it, although that is one of the very early twists. But if you're going to talk about it, you need at least a pronoun, a correct pronoun to refer to. Apart from that, I try and I give away as little as possible, but there are enough twists in it that you can pick and choose a couple. And the important thing is to make people realise, who are listening to it and you want to pay attention to the story, that this is, it's an undramatic life, but a life full of drama all the same, and it's just on this small scale, and it is on a scale that you expect to find in fiction. And I think all the more sort of powerful and moving because of that.
That was Alexander Masters there talking about his book A Life Discarded, 148 Diaries Found in a Skip, which is published by Fourth Estate. Helen Callahan is with me in the studio, author of Dear Amy. Helen, we're coming to the end of our time with you, sadly.
Oh, no.
I know, that's sad. It's gone very quickly. Now, you touched on your second novel there.
Yes.
And just going back to something Sarah Vaughan said about a tricky second novel, but she felt that this was the novel that she really became a writer. How is it going for you?
Well, it's been written. It was interesting in that sense. It was like Dear Amy, there was this absolutely thundering first draft where it was just sort of, you know, don't. I knew what I was going to write for a long time, and I kept, you know, researching and thinking about it. But there really is nothing quite like, you know, sitting down and cracking the whip over yourself. And I've had the edits back, so I'm about to start the rewrite, which is going to be interesting because it's amazing actually, because the minute you hit send, you're like, damn it, no, that should have happened. Oh God, no, and that. But the thing is about these things is that, you know, even after the book is published, I mean, I've not read Dear Amy since it was published, but I know, because I know that if I opened it, it would be like, oh no.
That's what all writers say, isn't it? It's unbearable reading extracts of their work because they want to change it.
Absolutely. They're never complete. They're, you know,
always a work in progress in your head. Yes.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, it's been lovely chatting to you. The paperback of Dear Amy is out this month.
It is. It's the 26th of January.
Good luck with that.
Oh, thank you.
We will sign out now with your last choice of music. Oh, no, let me jump ahead a little bit to what's in our next show before we hear your last choice, which is a wonderful track by Kate Bush. So the next show, our studio guest is Susan Quilliam. She's a relationship psychologist. She's author of 21 books on relationships, and she revised a classic text, The Joy of Sex, in 2008. Wait. So, yes, we'll be having a saucy chat with Susan in the next show. We'll also hear from poet Jenny Dunbar talking about her anthology of poetry, Thoughts of Time, and Glynis Cooper on her book Cambridge in the Great War. But let's get back to that Kate Bush track now. How to Be Invisible, your last choice of music, Helen. Why this one?
Well, this was a choice based on love. It's interesting actually, because she's actually singing the backing on the first track we played, No Self-Control. I just could hear her in the background because I've got such a fantastic sound system here. And so I chose How to Be Invisible because there's this element throughout Dear Amy of girls in care, of neglected girls, of almost in the sense that, you know, people who's, you know, when things happen to them, you know, people don't look quite as hard as they should. And I thought that, I just think this track is absolutely brilliant. That kind of like female neglect, it's just great.